Welcome to the Good Dog Pod. Join us every other Wednesday when we discuss all things dogs, from health and veterinary care to training and behavior science, as well as the ins and outs of Good Dog and how our platform can help you successfully run your breeding program. Follow us and join Good Dog's mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them. Thank you again to everyone for joining us today for our presentation on understanding tests used to assess stud dog fertility with our guest, Dr. Peggy Rutt. Today, we are going to learn how a breeding soundness exam and semen evaluation are important in determining fertility in male dogs. We've received so many questions from our community about this. Over the past few months, we're excited to have a webinar that focuses on this. We're also going to delve into less commonly used tests that aid fertility understanding, like a testicular ultrasound. I don't know if I'll pronounce this correctly. I'll let Dr. Rutt do that. Hyposmotic swelling.
Hyposmotic.
Was not even close. And assessment for acrosomal integrity and DNA damage. So lots of stuff for us to cover today. We're so excited Dr. Rutt is here with us. We're also, of course, so grateful to Purina for helping us bring this webinar to life for all of you. You know, I mentioned this already, but this is a topic so many breeders write emails to us about, they post in our Facebook group about, and there's just such a genuine curiosity around stud dog fertility. Of course, it's so important to breeders, so we're really excited to cover this topic today. So I'm sure everyone knows by now that we host a ton of webinars, 2 live ones every month. We've been doing that for many years, so we have built up quite a library in our Good Breeder Center of past webinars covering a wide variety of canine health topics. So if that's something that you're interested in, you can always browse through all of the recordings we have, because we have some really great ones in there. And of course, we're always having new ones added every single month as well. I mentioned this already, but during the Q&A segment of our presentation, we're going to be prioritizing some of the previously submitted questions from our community first. We got a ton of them, so we're going to do our best to go through those. All right, I think that is all housekeeping for today's webinar, but I just want to talk a little bit now about Good Dog for anyone who is joining us for the first time, and if you are, welcome. Good Dog is on a mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them by advocating for dog breeders like yourselves, educating the public, and promoting canine health and responsible dog ownership through events just like this. We are an online community that's created just for responsible dog breeders to connect with quality applicants from all across the country and find forever homes for your puppies. We help breeders run all aspects of their breeding programs with us. So everything from getting your litter of puppies listed, marketing that litter, connecting with buyers, getting to know them, taking payments securely for those puppies, and all of the smaller things that happen in between your litters being born and going off to their new homes. We are here to support breeders with that. We also have other offerings beyond placement software. We help breeders get access to free educational resources just like this. We have health-related discounts as well, so we can help your programs thrive in other ways too. So if you're not yet part of our community, we would love to have you join us. And you can learn more about our mission and apply to join at gooddog.com/join. And I think that's it about us, but of course, I would be remiss to not mention a little bit about the background of Dr. Rutt, who is our speaker today. Dr. Rutt retired in 2025, congratulations, after working nearly 40 years at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine as professor of small animal reproduction and assistant dean of education. After graduating from the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine in 1987, she worked in small animal private practice for several years and then returned to the university to complete a residency in theriogenology. She became board certified in theriogenology in 1994 and completed a doctorate degree in theriogenology in 1995. Dr. Rutt is the author of several books about small animal theriogenology written for veterinarians and for dog breeders, including The Dog Breeder's Guide to Successful Breeding and Health Management. So we are so excited to have her here today. I believe you joined us earlier in the year, I think around January. So we're so excited to have you back with us, Dr. Rutt. I will pass things over to you now to get started.
All right. Thank you very much, Nicole. Thank you for the invitation to come back and speak again. Yep, I was here in January, and I was talking then about welfare of breeding dogs. And the other topic I was asked to discuss is this topic of male fertility. And this is something that I often had to help clients with when I was still on clinics at the University of Minnesota. And the reason I think it's valuable for you to, as a dog breeder, to understand all of the different things that we can look at when we're assessing fertility is to help you understand why your veterinarian may recommend what they do and why sometimes we just need time to help us see what the dog can do. These aren't always things that we can address immediately. And I'll explain that more as we go through this presentation today. So today I'm going to talk about a breeding soundness exam. And a breeding soundness examination is more than just a semen evaluation. Oftentimes people will think that those two things are synonymous, and they are not. To really do a good, complete breeding soundness examination, your veterinarian needs to take a really good history. That's going to include things like any illnesses your dog has had, what their nutritional level is, what their activity level is, if they've been used for breeding and whether they were successful or not. All of those kinds of things help us understand what your dog might be doing as they are creating sperm, and whether or not they've been successful in the past helps guide us in knowing sort of how significant the problems are that you might be facing. So history taking, first big important thing. Second thing would be a good physical exam. And that's just not the normal physical exam to make sure your dog is healthy, although that's certainly part of it. It also should include a musculoskeletal exam, because if a dog is used for natural breeding, as you know from watching dogs breed, it's quite an effort for the male dog. And sometimes dogs will have problems because of musculoskeletal concerns and pain as they're trying to breed. And also should include a rectal examination, and that's for us to assess the prostate in the dog. The final part of the physical exam that should be done is a palpation of the scrotum. Are there two testicles there? Are they about the same size? Are they the right consistency? And so it's really important for us as veterinarians to have that history and that physical examination as sort of a background against which we judge some of the other tests we do. And the primary test that we'll do is the semen evaluation, which we'll talk about in detail. Other things that I'll talk about beyond the semen evaluation include things like culture. And as Nicole mentioned, we'll talk about testicular ultrasound. We'll also talk about some of the other things you see listed here, which are common tests that have been done for a long time in veterinary medicine. And then I will spend just a short time talking about sort of more advanced testing. Most of these are tests that are done more often in human medicine than they are in veterinary medicine. And oftentimes we don't know for sure what they mean when we get the results back for dogs, because we just don't have as much information. But I want you to be aware that they exist and to have some idea of how useful they are to us. So if your veterinarian mentions them, or if you read about them and want to talk to your vet about them in more detail, you have some sense of what they are about. So the big picture that I want you to take from this today is that none of us are Carnac the Magnificent. None of us are going to be able to tell you, no matter how detailed your history is, no matter how well we can do a physical exam, no matter how many tests we do, none of us are able to say to you for sure your dog will be fertile, and especially not be able to say your dog will be fertile at this time in the future. Very often, as you'll see, we're looking at sort of snapshots in time, and we have to really be thinking about what that might mean for your dog in the future. So let's talk about the breeding soundness exam. So like I say, first thing always, do that history, do that physical examination. Don't need to go over more of this because I've already discussed it. But this is a step that I find often people don't see as a vital part of the veterinarian's ability and your ability to use all of this information to help you make decisions. I can't really tell you a lot just from a semen evaluation. I need to have an idea of what your dog looked like as well and the history of your dog. So when we think about the semen evaluation, which is the step most people jump to right away when they're thinking about assessment for fertility, we really need to think about, well, what do we need the sperm to do? What do we need to have happen in that dog's reproductive tract and in the reproductive tract of the bitch after the semen is introduced into her reproductive tract at the time of breeding? What do we need to have happen? So first of all, we need those spermatozoa to form properly, to develop properly. And the spermatozoa, of course, develop in the testes. They are dumped into a central vein in that testes that dumps them out into the epididymis, which is sort of a tubular structure that lays on top of each testis. And that is where the sperm mature. That's where they actually gain their ability to move. And so they have to spend some time in that epididymis before they move on. It is 2 months from when they start to first form a spermatozoan till it is in the epididymis and ready to be ejaculated. And that 2 month window, that's for dogs specifically, very important to remember, because if your dog was injured 2 months ago or your dog had a high fever 2 months ago, the semen I'm seeing today might not look normal, and it's because of what happened 2 months ago. Similarly, if something is, we're going to change something right now, we're going to put them on a supplement or an antibiotic right now, we probably aren't going to see an awful lot of change for at least 2 months, because we haven't really impacted where those sperm are being developed. So that 2 month window is an important thing to remember when we're talking about this. Once those sperm are ejaculated or introduced into the female's reproductive tract, either by natural breeding, by artificial insemination, they need to move all the way through that tract. And while they're doing that, they undergo a process called capacitation. And capacitation does two things. It allows them to move from more of a meandering kind of motion to more of a straight line kind of motion. So their tail, instead of sort of giving that undulating motion that you think of, it sort of becomes fixed on the sperm, and it's almost like a little propeller. So that's part of it, is that the speed increases with which they can move. And then secondly, the head of the sperm has this tissue across it called the acrosome, and that's filled with digestive enzymes that will allow it to move through into the egg to cause fertilization. So capacitation is both that increase in movement and that reaction on top of the acrosome that is going to allow it to fertilize the egg. So those have to happen before fertilization can occur. Most of the time, the sperm are going to be there before the eggs are there and ready to be fertilized. And so they will bind. They'll bind to the uterus or the uterine tubes. You might also know them as the fallopian tubes, which are what connect the uterus to up to the ovaries. Somehow they know when it's the right time to detach and how to move up towards those eggs to effect fertilization. We believe that is a chemical signal, but we do not know exactly what that signal is. But they need to be able to bind, then to detach at the right time, and then to penetrate that egg. And so to get to the egg, the DNA of the egg itself is surrounded first by a very thick layer of tissue called the zona pellucida, and then by a bigger layer of cells called the cumulus cells. So that sperm has to get all the way through the cumulus cells and then all the way through that zona pellucida to get to the point where it can enter the egg. So the DNA from the sperm can form a single unit with the DNA from inside the egg. Once one sperm hits that spot, there's an electrochemical reaction so that only one sperm can do that. Because if you had multiple sperm fertilizing that egg, you'd have too much DNA, and that can't lead on to normal embryogenesis and formation of puppies. So this is all the stuff that we need to have happen. And as you can imagine, boy, that's kind of a miracle, really, that we ever get puppies, because there's so many things that have to happen at the right time and in the right sequence for fertilization to occur. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, the tests that we have available to us don't let us see if all those things can occur. The tests that we have are also going to be dependent on things like who collected the sample? When was it collected? How frequently does that dog ejaculate? How much sperm is in that ejaculate? How many spermatozoa are actually in that fluid? When you collect the sample, what happens to it? Do you look at it right away, or did it sit for a little while? And if it sat for a while, was it at room temperature or was it chilled? That's going to change what you see. Sometimes your equipment will matter. Was your equipment cold? Was your equipment too hot? Did it have soap residues or something in it that's actually damaging the sperm? Who's actually doing the evaluation? And there's certainly going to be some variability from person to person, just the natural variability in how we subjectively assess things. And then other factors as well, the age of the dog and things like that. So you can't just look at a list of, oh, these are the findings from a semen evaluation and this is normal, and really be able to evaluate it. You really have to include a lot of information in that interpretation to help you understand what the fertility likely is in that dog. I'm not going to talk about semen collection itself today. Usually we do what's called manual ejaculation in the dog, where you're going to collect the dog by getting the dog excited and having them ejaculate into some sort of container. I like to use what's shown here. It's sort of a rubber tube that's actually over the dog's penis, and it has that little plastic tube connected to it. So everything has to go into that tube. You're not worrying about the dog moving around as he's ejaculating and you're trying to catch it in a cup. Sometimes that can be a little bit tricky. And I'm not going to talk about that in detail today. What I want to talk about today is what we do with the sample once we have it. And this is the list of things that I will now go through in order that we do as part of a semen evaluation. So the first thing is the volume. And the volume is easy to assess. If you use a tube like this, you just read it off the tube. So this one would be 5 milliliters, just right off the tube. Easy peasy to do this test. The volume itself doesn't mean anything. And that's because when the dog ejaculates, they are first thrusting vigorously. That's when they ejaculate the sperm. And then after that, they will usually step down off of the female. They'll try to swing their leg around. You know how they'll turn up sort of butt to butt. And then they will secrete just prostatic fluid for a long time. And it's thought that that helps sort of move the semen forward into the bitch's reproductive tract. And they'll do that exact same thing when you're collecting them. So how much volume you collect is really up to you as the collector. If you stand there a long time and collect that prostatic fluid, this will just fill up the tube and your volume will be greater, but most of it will be prostatic fluid, which had no sperm in it. So volume in and of itself is not an indicator of quality. Having a small volume can be very fine. Having a large volume doesn't automatically mean that you're very fine. We will need volume. We'll need that number later to help us determine exactly how many sperm are in there. So we'd still have to keep track of that value. But just be aware, don't panic if your dog's volume is smaller. That doesn't necessarily mean anything bad for your dog. Just means you stopped collecting earlier. The color should be opalescent, that sort of nice pearly white color like you see in the left-hand image right there in the middle, that nice pearly color. They actually ejaculate in 3 separate fractions, and that's what's shown in that leftmost slide. The first is called the pre-sperm fraction. Might be a little bit cloudy, but it can be quite clear. Then you have the sperm-rich fraction, which is the beautiful pearly or opalescent color. And then the prostatic fraction, which is just clear prostatic fluid. There are no sperm secreted from the prostate. So that's just plain clear fluid. If you don't get any cloudy fluid, if all of your fluid is clear, then that suggests that you didn't get any spermatozoa, which means either there's something blocking it in the system or your dog was very apprehensive. And there are different tests we can do if that's what we see. Blood will either look bright red, as is shown in the center picture, kind of a tan color, and that's if it's been broken down a little bit. It'll look almost like iced tea. Or sometimes it will be very bright red, as is shown in the rightmost photo. And very often that will be from the presence of trauma or something that's making the surface of the penis bleed. When you see more of the iced tea or the lighter red, oftentimes that is suggestive of reproductive tract disease, and what we're usually looking for there is prostate disease. Once in a great while, you will have a dog that has raging infection in their reproductive tract, and you'll actually see pus. I remember very vividly once, it was a Siberian Husky, and as I was collecting it, the semen was that obviously pussy-looking fluid, that fluorescent-y yellow-green that you see with pus. That's uncommon for us to see it that overtly. Most of the time, it's going to be clear, opalescent, or bloody that you will see. You can measure the pH, and you can do that with a pH meter if you have one. Most commonly, people do it with pH paper, where you just dip the paper into the semen and then compare it to these different ranges that are on the tube that the papers come in. There's not very much information in the literature about what is normal pH, and that's something that not everyone will do. As a veterinarian, it's helpful to me because sometimes it helps me choose an antibiotic, but that requires you to have very specific information about how different antibiotics work at different pHs, and that sort of advanced pharmacology that you probably don't need to know as a dog owner. And so, yes, we might measure the pH, but it isn't like there's one pH that is absolutely the best or that any given number is particularly bad. Most of the time, it's going to be sometimes right, somewhere right in this range that's described of 6.4 to 6.8. Motility is an important thing to measure. Are those sperm moving? Sperm that are not moving are not necessarily dead, but we certainly worry that they might be dead, and that's why they're not moving. Sometimes it will be due to some sort of artifact. Like I said, maybe there's a soap residue or something that is stopping them from moving even though they're still alive. We don't have a great way to know for sure that they're alive or dead if they're not moving, but we certainly know if the sperm are not moving, they're not going to go anywhere to be able to fertilize that egg. And so this is an important thing to assess, and to assess fairly quickly after you collect the semen sample. And this is very simple. We're just looking for what percentage of the spermatozoa in that sample are moving forward. And we call that the percentage progressive motility. And we're looking for 70% or more. So you just put a drop on the slide, put it under the microscope, look right away. And that's because the longer it sits under the light of the microscope and gets heated up, the more the sperm will slow down. So you want to look at it right away. You can also use automatic systems, or what are called CASA systems, computer automated sperm analysis systems. And those work perfectly well. You'll see there's some things with CASA systems that aren't necessarily better than doing it by hand. This, it works perfectly well. So it can tell you what the motility is, about the same as a human set of eyes can tell you. The other thing we want to assess is morphology, or shape. So you stain or somehow prepare some of the sample and look at individual sperm under the microscope and look to see what percentage are normal. And you want 80% or more to be normally shaped. Sometimes a dog will not have had semen collected for a long time, or it'll be an older dog, and you'll see changes in morphology from that. And so you need to be aware, again, what's the history? What do I know about this dog? It'll change with how the slides are prepared, how they were stained, things of that nature. And it changes by evaluator. We did a study at the University of Minnesota that showed that the percentage that you came up with as normal, that was pretty much the same from one assessor to another. But if you were actually looking at the abnormalities themselves, that was getting a little more subjective. And so be aware that the big thing we're looking at here is that number of normal. When you get into thinking about the individual abnormalities, you're going to see some differences by your assessor. Again, you can use these CASA systems for this, and they're, again, correlated pretty well with what you find from your own eyeballs, your own direct microscopic evaluation. So if your veterinarian has one of these systems, I think you can trust those results. So here's an example of a way that you might create the slides. So what you're seeing here on the left is you've got one slide that's laying flat, and you've got one slide that's being held up. So it's sitting at about a 45-degree angle, and the little black dot is the dot of semen. So you pull back, you let that semen kind of film out against your pusher slide, and then you push it out, and you make sort of a film that you then let dry. And you stain. And you can use many different kinds of stains. The one that I'm showing here is a triple stain that's very often used in veterinary medicine for many things besides semen evaluation. And if you use that stain, they will take on kind of a purpley pink color like you see in the images on the far right. A normal sperm should have a head. On the top of that head is that little extra tissue called the acrosome that really isn't necessarily visible every time that you look at the sperm microscopically. The neck is just a small area that connects to the tail. And the tail is made up of the midpiece, which is thicker than the principal piece, and a very small end piece. The midpiece contains mitochondria. And any of you who've ever had cell biology learned the mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell. And that's exactly what they are. They provide the energy. And so you'll see when we look at abnormalities, we really want to know where abnormalities are forming. So for example, here on the picture shown on the right, you can see that both of these sperm have little bends in the tail, one way at the very end of the tail and one a little bit farther down. Those are not necessarily very likely to be real. This is probably just the way those sperm laid down and died, if you will, on that slide. And they don't really show that the sperm was developed abnormality or that anything really bad is happening. If the bend had been closer to the head within that midpiece section, that suggests that the midpiece got built wrong because it's a bigger and more complex part of the sperm. So you need to say not only, oh, are there bends in the tail? You need to think about where they are. How acute is that bend? And so again, there's a certain subjectivity that goes into determining what you're seeing, what's normal and what's abnormal. So the most important thing, as I said before, is what are the percentage that are normal? Some people will split out the abnormalities. Some people will do it as primary versus secondary abnormalities, or as major versus minor abnormalities. I prefer the primary versus secondary because primary just means it happened while they were being formed. So for example, the sperm up on the top there that coiled really tightly right by the head, that suggests that they were formed abnormality. That midpiece, which is bigger and more complex, is allowing it to bend when it should not. Whereas secondary abnormalities happen during storage, or it's an artifact of how you did it, like mild bends in the tail and things like that. Major versus minor suggests that we really know the impact of each of these abnormalities on fertility. And the only one we really know for sure is if the head and the tail are detached from each other. If you just have heads floating around, they're not going to move. Clearly, that's a bad thing. The rest of these, we really don't know for sure in many species what are the major and minor impacts of that given abnormality. And so for that reason, again, really focus on what percent is normal. And if you're going to think about abnormalities, I prefer to think of it, did it happen during the formation of the sperm or did it happen afterwards? As that might help me decide what next steps I'm going to recommend for you to assess what's happening with your dog overall. And as I said, as you might expect, motility, morphology, they're linked. So if you have no tail connected to that head, it's not moving. So if you have a lot of tailless sperm, obviously your motility is going to be low. So these two things will usually be well correlated. How many sperm are in there? That's a big question. And that, I think, is probably the one that most people really want to know. Are there enough sperm in there to do the job? And so remember that I told you the volume in and of itself was not valuable because it's not telling us anything except how much semen that we collected. So we're going to use it here only as a piece of the mathematical equation that'll tell us how many sperm are in there. Dogs should have between 300 million and 2 billion sperm in their ejaculate. And of course, I'm not going to sit there and count 300 million sperm, much less 2 billion sperm. What we're going to do is take a sample from that and then mathematically extrapolate how many sperm are in there. So what we're going to measure is the concentration. We're going to measure how many spermatozoa there are in each mil of the sample. And then we're going to multiply that by the volume, which is how many mils are in the ejaculate. And that will get me how many spermatozoa are in that ejaculate, the total number. And that is the valuable number. So what I'm going to measure is the concentration, but then I'm going to calculate the total number. And that's the more important number. So to measure the concentration, again, there's a couple of ways you can do it. This is one of the ways that you can do it if you do it by hand. So this little jug that you see with the purple bottom, that has a compound in it. Basically, it's dilute vinegar that will kill the sperm because they're obviously hard to count if they're still alive. So you're going to kill them. And that's a known volume of diluent in that little container. And the thing next to it that looks like a little poker, you use that to poke a hole in the top of this little container. And then you pull off this outer sheath and it has a little pipette in it. And that's a known volume in that pipette. I'm going to pull semen up into that pipette and then squirt it into that bottle. And then I'm going to squirt it out onto this glass slide, and the area in the center of that glass slide looks like what you see on the right. When I put it under the microscope, I'll see that grid. And what I'm going to do is to count the spermatozoa that I can see in that grid. And that's going to tell me the concentration. And then that concentration is going to get multiplied by the volume, and that will give me the total number. You can also do this using a CASA system, and here it's been shown to be at least as accurate. So I'll tell you, I was trained way before there were CASA systems. I can do a concentration very quickly. Other people may not be as trained, or they may have a high volume of these that they're doing, depending on the practice you go to, and they may use a CASA system, and that's generally been found to be perfectly adequate. As I said, normal, 300 million to 2 billion spermatozoa per ejaculate. And the reason it's this big range is because the number is dependent on how big the dog's testes are. So if you're a Chihuahua, you just automatically have smaller testes than if you are an Irish Wolfhound. And so we need to be thinking about that when we're assessing that number. If it's a really big dog and he's a healthy dog and his testes feel great and he has 290 million sperm, I'm less likely to be excited about that. You know, that's not good for that dog. If it's a Chihuahua and he's got 290 million sperm, he might be perfectly okay because he's got tiny testes. And so for him to be right off the edge of the low end of normal is probably okay. Sometimes in the semen evaluation, since we're looking at the semen, we'll look for other cell types. So we might look for inflammatory cells. And this here, what you're seeing, those are white blood cells, which would show inflammation or infection. We might look for red blood cells. Sometimes you'll see them microscopically, even if the sample doesn't look bloody. We might look for cells that have been shed from the prostate, and sometimes that's an indication of a certain amount of inflammation within the prostate. And we might look for immature germ cells, which means sperm that are being released before they're fully mature. And we don't always know what that means, but it generally makes us worry that something abnormal is happening in the testes themselves. So what are the other common tests that we use to assess fertility? Well, the first one of those is semen culture. And sometimes people will tell me, well, I'm going to look at the semen first and see if there are white blood cells in there, because if there's no inflammation in there, I'm not going to culture it. And it's been well shown that if you're suspicious of infection, you should just go ahead and culture the semen, whether you're seeing the inflammatory cells or not. If that semen was collected where it came out through the urethra and you collected it into that tube like I showed, there are going to be some bacteria in there. And that's because the bottom of the urethra has normal bacteria that live there. So when you get that culture back, you can't just say, oh, we grew any bacteria. That means it's significant. That's not necessarily true. You need to have more than 10,000 colony forming units or bacterial units per mil. That's significant. And usually you'll see only one or maybe two organisms. If you grow smaller amounts of three or four things, that's not significant. You're just growing what you captured coming through the urethra. Ultrasound is fairly commonly done, and that's a good idea. I know it seems like you'd believe you could feel a lot by palpation, and you can. I never skip the palpation piece, but there are certainly times that those testes felt good to me, and yet we found some abnormalities on ultrasound. So these are examples of what you might see on ultrasound. The far left picture is showing you a perfectly normal testis, and so you're seeing that sort of circular mass of tissue with sort of a nice even modeling. That's what a testis should look like. With that big bright echo in the middle, that's the tube in the middle where everything is going to get dumped before it goes up into the epididymis. So the left-hand picture is a beautiful normal testis. The one in the middle, you can see there's sort of a dark circle. It's almost kind of heart-shaped there. That's not normal. That could be fluid in there. That could be a tumor in there. But this way I'm looking at it, I know I could get a sample from it because I could stick a needle right into that and sample that and get an idea of what's abnormal in that testis. And then on the far right, you're seeing those really bright, you see those two really bright small dots. That is some sort of mineralization. We call this microlithiasis, meaning small stones that are in the testes. And as our ultrasound equipment has gotten better, and as more of us have used a really trained ultrasonographer to look at the testes, we find these more often. We don't really know if they are going to impact fertility or not. That's sort of an ongoing thing, that these have not been well described historically in the literature. But if you see them, you might want to check the dog more frequently than you would otherwise, getting semen evaluated on a regular basis if the dog is being used for breeding on a regular basis. Usually we will think about prostatic diagnostics, and that's because every male animal, every species of animal, has a different number of glands that provide the fluid for the semen. Dogs have one. They have a prostate. Everybody's got a prostate. That's the only one that the dogs have. And so because so much of what we see on the semen sample comes from the prostate, it oftentimes is very valuable to do prostate diagnostics. So that's why we did the rectal exam, like I talked about right at the beginning. In a perfectly normal dog, when you put your finger into that rectum, you should be able to feel their prostate. It should feel like this, where you have a little bump on each side and a little hollow in the middle, and it shouldn't be painful to the dog. As it gets bigger, it will fall forward into their abdomen. You may not be able to feel it, and that's where you might go to something like prostatic ultrasound. And looking at the prostate under ultrasound, you could pass a needle into any abnormal looking areas, or if you sedate the dog, you can do a biopsy where you take an actual piece of the prostate at that time. You can also culture the semen. You can culture the prostatic aspirate that you just did with your fine needle to look for infection there. And then finally, you know, in men, they do PSA testing for the prostate. And we don't do that as often in dogs because it isn't as consistent in being able to identify concerns in dogs as it is in people. But dogs do have their own specific prostate enzyme, CPSE, canine prostatic specific esterase. And that testing can be done, although it's not routinely done. It might be hard to find a lab in your area that does it. Would be a good idea to check the dog for brucellosis. And brucellosis is a disease I'm sure you've all heard of. It's a bacterium, very contagious, can cause infertility problems in both bitches and stud dogs. Females very classically will lose pregnancies late in gestation, but both bitches and stud dogs can carry brucellosis with no outward signs of disease. And so it's a good idea to be checking your male dog for it. And I would say whenever they're being used for breeding, or if you're not using the dog quite as commonly for breeding, maybe at least every 6 months while he's being actively out there in the breeding world. I don't have time to talk a lot about brucellosis today, but I'd be happy to talk about that more at another time if a lot of you are interested in that. And then some people will want to do testosterone assays. And testosterone is important because it is what drives sperm production, and it is released sort of in pulses over the day. So there's no value in collecting just one sample because you don't know that you caught them at the top of the peak or the bottom at the peak. So you might have to take multiple samples or somehow give them something to make them release their testosterone so you can see the value that you get. Some studies have shown that dogs that have poor fertility or that were completely infertile had lower resting testosterone than normal fertile dogs. But really, it's not very clear yet how we would use testosterone well as a treatment in all dogs. So this is something that you can look for, but it isn't always clear what you're going to do with the result that you get back. Fine needle aspirate. All right, again, just exactly like the name sounds, you can pass a very fine needle into the testis, which most dogs tolerate pretty well, although I sedate them to do it. Or you can take a biopsy, and that's a surgical thing. So for that, they're under general anesthesia, where you actually take a piece of the testis. And this might sound like ways to damage the testes, but generally the testes recover well from these two things. And it really does tell you a lot of information. Is there inflammation inside that testis? Is there infection in that testis? Are there any of the cells that we need to make spermatozoa still within that testis? And so it's an invasive test, but sometimes it really helps answer your question, especially for a dog that you have hopes for long-term use as a breeding animal. Okay, so let's take a couple of minutes and talk about more advanced testing. There are some other hormone tests you can do. We talked about testosterone. Testosterone is an easy hormone to assay. It's what's called a steroid hormone, which means it's the same actual molecule in any species. So you could do your dog's testosterone assay in a human lab and it would be equally accurate because testosterone is testosterone. And so that one you can get done almost anywhere. Two other hormones that people are interested in testing are follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. These come from the pituitary gland in the brain. They're named for what they do in the female. Follicle stimulating hormone helps provide some of the support for the creation of the sperm, and luteinizing hormone is what stimulates the release of testosterone. So you could see where loss of either of those in a male would lead to some abnormalities of testicular function or libido or things like that. The problem with these two hormones is that they are not steroid hormones. They are protein hormones. So at a molecular level, they are different than what we see in other species. So if you measure FSH in a dog sample using a human assay, it may not be accurate. And the same with LH. And so because we don't have assays available routinely that are specific for the dog, sometimes you don't know for sure, even if you can get a test result, what that test result means, because you don't know if the test itself was accurately telling you what was there. One other hormone that has been sort of more recently described is anti-Mullerian hormone. An anti-Mullerian hormone is important when dogs are developing embryologically. The Mullerian system is the female system. And all puppies are born with both systems. So if you're going to be a male, you have to have some anti-Mullerian hormone because then that will cause dissolution of the female system so they can develop the male ducts and the male, the testes and everything that we expect for reproductive anatomy in a male animal. But it's been shown that animals will actually produce this hormone for a long time. And some studies have shown that this anti-Mullerian hormone will be evaluated in some dogs with some particular pathologies. This is a new thing. Not as much research is out there. So again, hard to say for sure what it means for you to have a single AMH value in a dog, but it's something that you might see or read about in the literature that your veterinarian might mention to you. Live dead staining is something that's been available for a long time. And this is where you take that semen sample and you stain it with a specific kind of stain called eosin-nigrosin stain, which is a black stain. I know it doesn't look like it looking at the picture, but it is, the stain will look black. And if the sperm are dead, the whole big membrane that surrounds the whole sperm, like a coat, will be broken. And that will allow stain to get in next to the sperm and it will turn them pink. So the pink ones are dead because they have damaged membranes. They're not going to be able to function normally. The white ones are live. So it's sort of a quick and dirty way to look at a slide, especially if nobody's moving, and try to decide, well, how many of them are really dead? There are, however, no good studies that absolutely correlate what you find on a live dead stain with how fertile the dog is. So it's an interesting test to do, but again, doesn't really give us a lot of diehard information we can use regarding your dog's future fertility. The acrosome, remember I talked about, was that little band of tissue over the top of the head of the sperm that is going to be activated during capacitation with that release of enzymes that will allow it to move through those cumulus cells in that zona pellucida to fertilize the egg. So some people worry about when that acrosome is activated. When does that capacitation occur? So if it happens way too soon, then those sperm are probably dead by the time the eggs are ready to be fertilized. If it doesn't happen at all, they're not going to be able to fertilize the egg. So there are different stains and microscopic techniques you can use to try to see what's happening with the sperm and try to decide whether you have problems with the acrosome or not. Again, these tests exist. Very few studies exist to help us really know how to use that information to assess fertility in a dog. Here's the hypoosmotic swelling test that Nicole mentioned briefly at the beginning. So the HOST test, or hypoosmotic swelling test, is something that's fairly commonly done in human medicine. In human medicine, if they look at the semen sample and fewer than 50% of those sperm are progressively motile, so moving and moving forward, they will do this hypoosmotic swelling test. And the idea with this test is, again, we're looking at that membrane. The whole sperm is in one membrane. And if the membrane is intact and you put those sperm in a specific type of medium, a hypoosmotic medium, fluid is going to move in next to the sperm. And it's going to take up space and the tail will coil up. And so that again tells you if they're alive or dead. If they're dead or if the membranes are damaged, they won't coil up. It's an interesting test to do. Again, similar to the live dead test with the staining, I don't know that we always have anything to correlate it with that tells us very much specifically about something we could correct in the dog that's causing the infertility problem you might have brought him in for. There are advanced kinds of imaging. So the imaging I showed you before, that ultrasound where I showed you the three pictures, the normal, the one with the abnormal spot in it, and then the microlithiasis, that's called B-mode ultrasonography. And that's the one we're all most commonly used to seeing, where you're watching it in real time. You can take samples from it in real time and watch as you take the sample. Very useful information. But there are other advanced ways that you can use ultrasound, either looking at Doppler type of images where you're watching things move forward and away, or using something called elastography, where you're actually looking at the tissue, the architecture of the sample itself. Again, very, very new, not something that's probably going to happen at your regular veterinary clinic. This is going to be a radiologist who does this for you. And again, not a lot in the literature yet about what things mean as we see those changes on these kind of advanced ultrasound images. DNA fragmentation testing is thinking about the actual DNA that's within the head of the sperm. So a lot of this that we've been talking about is really talking about the sperm itself. And the sperm itself is really just a little package. It's just a little way to get that DNA into that egg so we can have fusion of those two things into enough DNA to make a dog, to make a puppy. And so this is actually looking specifically at the DNA. And what you're really looking at sometimes are changes in head shape, that it isn't necessarily something specific to the DNA, although there are some tests, some dyes that try to identify that as well. This is very often done with some sort of CASA system. This is not something you can look at easily microscopically. These are much more specialized kind of tests. These are not stains that your veterinarian will have in their regular clinic. And you need a CASA system because you're really looking at very nuanced changes in the size and shape of the head. Again, something that's used in human medicine. We just don't have that much information about it yet in canine medicine. And then there's anti-sperm antibody testing. So anti-sperm antibodies would be antibodies raised against sperm. And so this is something that they worry about in human medicine. So they worry about in human medicine, if you and your partner are infertile, is it because basically, if you're the woman, you are sort of allergic, if you will, to the male sperm, that you have antibodies. So when the sperm are introduced, those antibodies bind to the sperm and actually keep it from functioning normally. So in human beings, if 20% of the sperm react in this kind of testing, they consider that they have significant anti-sperm antibodies and that that's going to keep them from being able to have normal fertilization of eggs. Again, we can test for anti-sperm antibodies. We can find those in dogs. But again, we don't always know what they specifically mean. And then there are zona binding assays. And this is looking at, can those sperm actually do what we ask them to do? Are they actually able to get through those cumulus cells, get to the zona pellucida, bind to it properly, and enter the egg? So these are described, but they're very technologically demanding. Usually you're using something like a hamster egg, and you're putting the sperm in there, and then you're trying to determine who makes it to the zona pellucida. Fortunately, it has been shown that morphology is probably our best indicator of whether or not all those things could actually happen. And so that's where we tend to rely in dogs, is thinking about morphology more than actually asking for these zona binding assays, although they do exist in human medicine. So let's take just a minute to think about how we're going to interpret results. So first, we have to think about all the different things besides just those numbers and the semen evaluation to help us make decisions. How old is the dog? Dogs that are greater than 10 years of age have been shown to have some changes in their morphology and their motility. So, for example, they'll have more proximal droplets and tail defects than younger dogs do, and that's probably going to impact their motility. Remember that all dogs, no matter who they are, how many sperm they can make is dependent on the size of their testes. And so we will measure their testes, both looking for pathology and looking for, does he have what I would consider normal testicular size for a dog of his breed? And then that's going to help you interpret that 300 million to 2 billion. I don't, again, expect to see the same number of sperm from a toy breed than I would expect from a giant breed of dog. How long has it been since semen was collected? So again, we've got that 60-day window. So we need to know what's been happening in the last 60 days. For me, I'd like even like the 90 or 120 days. I had one dog once. He would go every summer down to Louisiana. He stayed in a place where he laid on top of a doghouse that had asphalt shingles on it. He cooked his scrotum every summer. Then he would come home to Minnesota at the end of the summer, and he would have shockingly horrible semen quality for a couple of months until his testes recovered from having been cooked in Louisiana all summer. That was an important thing for me to know about his history, because I knew I was seeing changes that had happened before. Sometimes if a dog hasn't ejaculated for a long time, you'll have a lot of sperm that are sitting in their epididymis that are older sperm. Call that a rusty load. And so you'll see a lot of sperm with defects. And that one, I would say, if I collected a sample and had poor morphology and the people said, well, he hasn't been used for breeding in 2 months or 4 months, then I would say, okay, let's just wait and collect another sample. And sometimes you can collect another sample right away. Your numbers will go down if you collect really, really frequently in a dog. Usually they need about every other day before they can really keep up their sperm numbers. Otherwise, you're just using up what's in the epididymis. But again, if you know that, if you know that you just collected a sample and then an hour later you collected another sample, if the number's down a little bit, you know that. And so you can interpret it wisely using that information. Where was the semen collected? So certainly if a dog is apprehensive or hesitant during collection, you're not going to get the same quality of semen that you would get if the dog is comfortable where they're being collected. So some dogs have been disciplined for mounting, and then they're going to be apprehensive, and you're not going to get the same kind of semen sample. Maybe it's a slippery surface, and they're worried they're going to slip. Maybe the teaser bitch isn't a dog that they like. Maybe there's no teaser bitch at all. So there's lots of different things that could happen in the environment and with the collector that will change the quality of what you get for your evaluation. Some literature suggests that there's a correlation of semen quality with season of the year. Certainly, if you're a place where the dog is very hot or very cold, that is going to impact semen production. So like I told you, I had that poor dog who sat on that hot doghouse all summer long in Louisiana. That was too hot. We see the same thing here in Minnesota with frostbite. So if a dog gets frostbite of their scrotum, that's going to impact their semen production. And then finally, when you're interpreting this, you really have to think about, well, what do we know? How do we know that this test means anything when we're thinking about fertility? Because for some tests, we just don't know that yet. So here's an example, something for you to think about. So this is a message, would be super classic message for me. Hey, Dr. Root, I brought one of my bitches to see you years ago, but since then I've gotten a new stud dog and he is not getting the job done. My vet says the dog looks good on physical exam. His sperm number looks okay. They're moving normally. I've used him to breed two bitches. They're both proven bitches, and neither of them took. Nobody got pregnant. Any ideas on next steps? So take just a second to think about what questions you might want to ask this person before you say anything about their dog. Okay, here's what I would want to know. What's the breed of your dog? What is the age of your dog? What is the history of your dog? What is the dog eating? Has it been tested for brucellosis? Things like that nature. How was the semen collected? When was the semen collected relative to when the dog did these breedings? How did the dog look when the semen was collected? What else did they find? What's the whole history? What's the whole physical examination findings? Did they find anything that leads us to believe that there might be testicular or prostatic problems? And then finally, how did they time the breedings? Every time you breed a bitch, there is a whole equation there. There's all the things that could happen to the bitch and all the things that could happen to the male, and all of them have to be right for us to get a pregnancy. So how did you time the breeding? How many times did you breed her? You say she was proven. How long ago was that? All of those kind of questions would help you understand best what's actually happening. So big picture, you need to know a lot of things to help you make decisions when you think about fertility. There's lots of different tests that we can do. Rely on your veterinarian. Give them a good history. Let them do a good physical exam. Think about which tests are most logical. And then always leave that 2 months of time, that window of time, to be thinking about what might have happened and what you might do going forward. All right. What questions can I answer for you?
Thank you so much, Dr. Rutt. That was amazing. We do have quite a few questions. I'm going to do my best to consolidate them so we can get to as many as possible.
Okay.
So we have a few just kind of around baseline breeding soundness exams. And one of these questions I thought was great, asking if a stud is already producing healthy litters with no issues, is there still value in getting a baseline workup?
That's a good question. I would say it depends on what you're going to want to do with that stud. So if you're going to use him for natural service, and that's what he's been doing, and he's been successful, I don't see that there's any magical reason for you to go into the vet with him. If you're thinking of getting semen frozen or using chilled semen, then it might be a good idea. And that's because sometimes you'll find out you can't get a semen sample from that dog. And then you're going to have to be thinking about, well, how are we going to do that moving forward? And this is especially important if you're going to freeze semen. I've seen many times that people just waited until way too late in a dog's life to decide it was time to freeze semen. And then the dog wasn't healthy anymore, or the dog was so apprehensive that we couldn't get a sample from him, or you name it, 100 other problems. So I think it really, really relies on what is your goal for the dog. If you're being successful and you're just going to breed naturally, natural service, and everybody's happy with that, nothing magical about going to the vet.
And in terms of breeding soundness exams, how often is it worth repeating over the course of a stud's career?
I would say for me, I like to see a dog once a year. They age so much more quickly than we do that a lot of times you will catch things early if you get to see the dog once a year. So I like to know what's happening. I like to make sure we've got a fairly recent brucellosis test in hand, all of those sorts of things. So ideally for me, I would see the dog once a year.
Great. Okay, we have some next questions about reading a semen evaluation. Mm-hmm. I know you had just used this example of heat exposure affecting a sample, but how do things like also recent fever and illness affect a sample, and how long would you say it should take for the quality of the sperm to bounce back?
So illness in and of itself, if it's not associated with fever or trauma, doesn't necessarily impact anything. Sometimes it will for reasons you wouldn't expect, like the dog lost a ton of weight while they were sick or something like that. Reproduction is a luxury. So if the dog is fighting hard, like a dog with cancer might be fighting very hard to stay alive, or they might have some immunosuppression from some disorder, then semen quality is probably going to suffer because that is not something their body needs to keep up. Fever is going to be that 2 month window. So fever is impacting the dog because the blood is too hot. And so even though the testes are hanging out in the scrotum away from the body, if the blood is too hot, then the testes are too hot. And again, it's going to be 2 months at least from when that fever has resolved for me to expect to see normal semen quality. Mm. Trauma is going to depend on what exactly happened to those testes. So I've known dogs who got in a dog fight. They ripped the scrotum open. They got it right in. We took care of it. There was minimal inflammation. The dogs never showed a hiccup and how bad things looked. I've known dogs that were like kicked by a horse in the scrotum. And those dogs, it took months and months and months because right. There was a ton of inflammation in there. So it's very dependent on what the specific disorder is.
And with all of that in mind, it sounds like there can be so much variety from one sample to the next. Mm-hmm. How much can one sample vary? And if results do come back low, how many times, and I guess how far apart would you advise breeders to retest before they're drawing any conclusions.
Yeah, I would never condemn a dog on one sample. If it's the very first time I'm seeing a dog, even if we get what we feel like is a good sample, I don't know how nervous the dog was. How do we know what's happening in the dog's mind when we get that sample? And so I think it's too strong a thing to say to anyone from any one sample, this dog will never be fertile or this dog should not be used again. I usually don't ask to see it much more than about a month apart. And that's just because I don't see a tremendous amount of value in spending my clients' money, having them come back and back and back within a short period of time. Now, that might vary if they say, you know, I really want to breed this bitch that I have. This is her last time I'm going to breed her. She's 7 years old. I really need to know. Well, then, okay, maybe we'll do it more frequently. But I would say for me, generally, I ask for about that month or two in between. And that just to me is sort of hitting that nice balance that I'm not sort of needlessly seeing the dog too frequently, but I'm not ignoring the dog for a long time either.
Great. Now we have a next set of questions from breeders who are just kind of curious of when to go beyond the standard tests. Someone had asked if a stud looks completely normal on a standard evaluation, but still isn't achieving pregnancies, which of these tests that you had mentioned tends to be the most revealing?
Well, there isn't one. I guess I'd say if I had a dog that was no history of any problems, looks great on physical exam, being bred to proven bitches, my first questions would be a lot of questions about the bitches. How are you timing your breeding for those bitches? You say they were proven. Who were they bred to in the past? Are they too closely related to him? You know, there's a lot of those sort of questions on the bitch side of things that I would want figured out. If it sounds like they're doing a magnificent job on the side of the bitches, then I'd go looking for infection, because that's probably going to be the easiest thing to identify that we can do anything about. So I would do a prostate workup. I would probably ultrasound those testes. If I saw anything abnormal, I would do a fine needle aspirate of those testes. And so those are the sorts of things I would probably go to first, just because let's say I can identify on one of these tests some weird acrosome problem. I can't fix a weird acrosome problem. I can fix an infection. So I would look for things that we would have some hope of being able to impact, I guess.
And specifically for testicular ultrasounds, would you say those are mainly for diagnosing an existing problem, or can breeders rely on that to also catch any trouble before it shows up in the semen quality?
That's a hard thing to answer because, again, it depends on what's happening in that testis. So if whatever is in there causes inflammation, you're going to see changes very quickly because testes do not like to be too warm. And so you will definitely see things happen more quickly. Something like testicular neoplasia, that's something that we don't tend to see in dogs until they're quite a bit older. And I've known some dogs that had really quite a large neoplasm in one testicle. And if it wasn't causing inflammation and increasing the temperature within the scrotum or releasing hormones that caused atrophy of the other testicle in the scrotum, their semen quality stayed pretty okay. There's also sort of a compensatory mechanism in place that if a testis is damaged, but again, in a way that leaves the other testis okay, or even if that testis is removed, it's like the other testis somehow knows that the one is gone. And actually, you can get a pretty good rebound no matter what. So that's a hard question to answer. I certainly wouldn't say I think everybody should have a testicular ultrasound done on their dog every 6 months. It isn't like we're likely to catch stuff that we wouldn't have any other clue of. So, yeah, because testicular neoplasia would be the thing we worry about the most, but it's not like it is in men where they get it when they're young and it's very aggressive. They get it when they're old and it's usually pretty benign. And so we can castrate them at the time we find it and they're fine.
Speaking of old, this is a question we had about for an aging stud, what fertility changes should breeders expect? And are there tests that can help them decide when to retire or bank the semen?
I would say you can expect that there's going to be a decline in their morphology and therefore a decline in the motility. Their testes will often feel softer. I think it is important to always collect semen and look at it, even if their testes feel softer, because sometimes they will feel bad, but they're still working fine. And so you really just need to make sure you know what they're still doing, not just what they feel like. Oftentimes, their sperm numbers will stay pretty good. They might start to slowly go down. But even if they have abnormal morphology, remember, that's a percentage we're looking at. And so if they have a billion sperm and 80% of them are still normal, that's still a lot of sperm. And they're still going to be perfectly capable. So I think you need to have all the numbers so you can sort of do that math. Generally, it's suggested that you need at least 250 million sperm to be able to affect a pregnancy. So if your dog is 400 million sperm and only 50% of them are progressively motile, he's only got 200 million sperm. That means you would have to use him multiple times over her heat cycle to be likely to get her pregnant. And if he's an old dog and his libido is getting poor because he's a little bit arthritic or something, then you're probably just not going to get that many breedings out of him. As far as what it means for having semen quality that's okay to preserve the semen, that's going to depend on the specific abnormalities that you see and how you're preserving the semen. So some people are going to have the capability to use filters or other things that they can centrifuge the sperm with that will remove the abnormal sperm and leave the normal sperm. And sometimes that will survive semen freezing, for example, better than people who just use the sample the way they collected it. So you would really want to talk to whoever is doing your semen preservation to find out what they have available and what they recommend.
Great. That actually brings me to another question that we had received. I know for breeders, access to specialists can be kind of a challenge depending on where they live. So someone had asked, if I don't live near a specialist, how can I figure out which tests are worth traveling for and which my regular vet can handle?
I would ask your regular vet to contact a theriogenologist and get advice from them, because most vets have some idea who's the closest. And if they don't, they can always contact the Society for Theriogenology, and the Society for Therio will tell you, well, here are the people who do repro work who are the closest in your area. And I was always happy when people would call me and say, hey, I live in the middle of nowhere in far northern Minnesota. I don't know if it's worth driving down to the Twin Cities. Here's what's happening with mine. And I could give that vet recommendations that then they were kind of working with the client and me to help them decide if they needed to drive all the way down the state or not. And so I would say the Society for Therio, they are your friend. They will find somebody for you and your vet to work with, even if it's just a phone conversation.
Amazing. That's great advice. Okay, we have just two last questions left. I thought these might be helpful for newer breeders in our community who maybe are just getting started and just trying to figure out where to begin. So one of the questions was, before I use a young stud for the first time, what's the one test you would say is an absolute non-negotiable?
Brucellosis.
Okay, easy answer for that one. I love a straightforward answer.
Brucellosis, yeah. Just because it can wreak so much havoc if we don't catch it. So it isn't that it's terribly common, although it is becoming more common as dogs move around more in the United States, but it can take out a kennel. So brucellosis.
Hey, great takeaway. And then last question is, do everyday things like a stud's weight and the food they're eating actually affect fertility, or is that overblown?
I think their weight certainly can. If they're a fat enough dog that they're packing fat down around that scrotum, that's not good, because then it's getting too hot down there. And they're actually probably not as active as they should be in a lot of those things. Nutrition is always difficult because there's so many variables in the food and in the dog that it's always really hard to say this food did this for this dog. And that sort of gets at the idea of supplements too, that people will often ask me, well, is it okay to give these herbal supplements or these fish oil supplements or whatever. There's just a lot we don't know about nutrition. And so short of there being some sort of toxin in the food, I think it's difficult to say this is absolutely a food that will improve fertility, or this is absolutely the food that destroyed a dog's fertility.
Mm. Amazing. Thank you for answering all of those questions. That was such a great Q&A. And thank you for such an amazing presentation. We love having you join us and present to our community. And I think I speak on behalf of everyone here, just judging by our chat feedback, that everyone loved this presentation. Great. They got a lot out of it. So just thank you so much again, Dr. Rowe. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Of course. And thank you to our community for joining us, for asking such thoughtful questions. As I mentioned, this was all recorded, so it will be available later today in the Good Breeder Center. It'll also be in our Friday newsletter, so lots of places for you to get the link to that. And I will just leave everyone with a preview of our next webinar, which will be Wednesday, August 12th at 1 p.m. Eastern on Zoom. And it will be with Dr. Victor Stora, who is going to be teaching us all about the principles of maintaining healthy, sustainable breeding lines across multiple generations. So total gear shift into genetics, but we're looking forward to that. And until then, I hope everyone has a wonderful day, and we'll see you back here soon. Thank you, everyone.